Welcome to the Environmental Transformation Podcast, where we talk with industry leaders who are making an impact in their businesses. Each leader is solving complex challenges and providing solutions within their respective areas of expertise. Our host is Sean Grady. He is passionate about helping clients transform their businesses and solving their environmental challenges. And here's our host, Sean Grady.
Hello, everyone. Today's guest is Dyron Hamlin. He's a professional chemical engineer and a certified industrial hygienist. He's worked on hundreds of hazardous material emergencies and spills over the years and supported litigation support projects. He manages GHD's first emergency response and industrial hygiene practices at GHD. And, you know, he is a recognized expert in the industry, and we're really excited to have him join the show today to talk about the certified industrial hygienist's role in the industry and its response to COVID-19. We're looking forward to the show. Dyron Hamlin, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining the Environmental Transformation Podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man. So I gave the listeners a little bit of a brief introduction about you. And so we've covered a little ground there for you already. But, you know, I was curious to know, like, how did you get involved with the evaluation of control of human exposure to chemicals in this field?
Yeah, so my background was in chemical engineering. I've always had an interest in chemistry. Found engineering was not quite the same thing. Ended up going back to grad school, and I specialized there in doing dispersion modeling. So air dispersion modeling is basically predicting air concentrations downwind of a chemical release. And that led one thing sort of led to the other on that. And, you know, those concentrations can have bearing on people's exposure. So I worked in kind of an emergency response space and looking at reevaluating what happens when there are chemical releases, doing some expert witness work, you know, kind of reconstructing spill events and things like that to determine what people are exposed to and what implications that might have or might not have on their health.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's pretty interesting. I mean, you know, I've always been fascinated by, you know, how someone can predict, you know, air being transported in the atmosphere and potential exposure. And, you know, how do you guys go about doing that actually, you know, in real time? Say in the case of a spill.
Sure. Yeah. It's one of those never a dull moment sort of lifestyles, kind of like the fireman sliding down the pole, which sometimes is fun and sometimes is, a real pain, to be honest with you. But yeah, when we get the call, I instantly just sort of go into, you know, my little bag of tricks and my background and, you know, thank the Lord for the internet, where I can get, you know, ready information. I've got a few resources I typically will go to, looking at things like vapor pressures and, you know, some of the chemical properties. It really becomes, you know, unless it's a chemical that I've dealt with before, it's a lot of study on the fly, looking up applicable exposure guidelines. So there's a few that we use pretty regularly in emergencies. And one is the US EPA puts out what's called the acute exposure guideline limits, the AEGLs. And so a lot of times we'll look at those. They have applicability in, you know, for workers and also for even sensitive members of the community. So it's, you know, it's a challenge. It's a real, they're always a dynamic situation trying to, you know, figure out from people maybe first on scene as to what they're seeing and smelling. And, you know, there's just any number of, little factors that come into play.
So you guys are using various monitoring equipment when you get out there to start, you know, gauging the concentrations of chemicals. I'm assuming also you're probably looking at safety data sheets of the various products that are known to be present.
That's right. Yeah. So, And different companies, you know, that we work with, or different clients or agencies that we work with, will have different resources that they can share with us pretty quick. So, if, for example, if it's a truck incident, there's going to be a bill of lading that's going to lead to an SDS. We like to get product-specific information if at all possible, but sometimes that's a little slow in coming. So, you know, initially, what I tell people about modeling is, and you know, monitoring and whatever it is trying to characterize an incident is, you take every little bit of information that you can. So maybe as an example, I know I've had a hydrochloric acid. We run into it fairly frequently. It's a pretty common chemical, and it's shipped a couple of different ways. You have hydrochloric acid solutions. You have pure anhydrous hydrogen chloride. And, you know, one of the first questions that I'll ask somebody, if they say, "Well, we've got this spill going on and it's hydrochloric acid," my first question is it a green cloud or is it a white cloud? And, you know, that's going to tell me if it's green, it's probably the anhydrous form. If it's white, it's probably in a solution form. So sometimes it's, you know, monitoring can be visual, monitoring can be odor. Can you detect it? We can work from odor thresholds, but certainly when you get into the more detailed measurements. Yeah, we've got what we've done internally as a company is we've equipped about 35, 40 offices with a real basic suite of air monitoring equipment. And if we can get them out quickly and start getting actual concentration data, that helps us kind of zero in on, you know, what levels we're looking at.
Okay, so that definitely helps you start managing the process of, you know, protecting, you know, those that potentially exposed. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that sounds great. Well, you know, part of the reason I'm doing this podcast, and I think we talked about this, you know, before you came on, is I really am wanting to kind of do a series on the credentials in the industry. And so, you know, CIH, the Certified Industrial Hygienist, is one of the credentials in the industry that carries a lot of weight, recognition, you know, and there's a couple others that we're going to cover as well on the podcast and very, you know, subsequent shows. But today I wanted to kind of really focus on the CIH and its role in the industry. And, you know, something that's really prevalent right now is its role in addressing COVID-19, you know, pandemic response as well. So, you know, when did you become a certified industrial hygienist?
Yeah, so I took my CIH exam a little over 3 years ago. I have been working in the industrial hygiene space really now for about probably close to 20 years. I've always worked around and among other certified industrial hygienists. And, you know, one thing I like about it is it's sort of encouraging community. It's one, when I made mention that I might, you know, look to study for and sit for my certified industrial hygiene certification. The people just came out of the woodworks with resources and tips and, you know, kind of their own experiences. And I've just found it to be, you know, a really cohesive group that kind of appreciates, I call it maybe like a brothers in arms sort of relationship, you know, a shared suffering, I guess, of having to sit through a pretty brutal exam.
Sure. Yeah, I can
Yeah,
imagine that.
about 3 years.
I imagine that test is pretty extensive.
It is, and I think that's one of the real challenges and one of the benefits that comes from, you know, industrial hygiene is it is pretty broad. And to cover all of the different topics that fall under industrial hygiene, where you have noise exposure, radiation, chemical exposures, PPE, biological exposures. There's a whole section on toxicology. You kind of have to know a pretty detailed amount of information about a lot of different subjects. Ventilation, for example, is one I didn't mention. So that leads to a test that could cover an extremely wide range of subjects about which you got to know quite a bit.
Yeah.
So you don't really know what's coming in the next question. And yeah, I think that's part of what makes the now it's down. It used to be a 2 day test, and now it's down compressed into about a 6 hour test in two sections.
Okay.
And it's a computer based test, was when I took it, and it was the longest 6 hours of my life. So, right. It was brutal.
Yeah, I can remember me studying for the CHMM exam, and that was the same scenario. It was a long test, and I don't know. I don't think it was 6 hours. I think it was more like four, but still, nonetheless, it was a ton of material to cover. Very challenging to test and exam to pass. So,
yeah,
kudos to the professionals who spend the time to advance their career and achieve this recognition and credential. What's the difference between the CIH and maybe a certified safety professional? Because I think those two professions and those designations are kind of similar in the industry. But if I was to, as a layman, explain, I think the CIH is like, kind of a step above in the sense that it's really looking out for other, exposure scenarios versus, am I managing the safety aspects of, occupational health and stuff at the industrial level or, worker exposure level. So maybe you can shine a little light on the difference there. That'd be good.
Sure. And you do see a lot of overlap. You see a lot of CIHs that will sit for their CSP as well and vice versa. The CSP, I kind of went over the different sections and segments and subjects that comprise the CIH certification. The CSP, the Certified Safety Professional, and I am not a CSP, so there are probably some that could speak to this a little more authoritatively than I could, but I do have a couple of CSPs in my group. Is that focus is really more around the day-to-day safety issues, and a lot of them are the kind of physical conditions of the workplace. So I always think of it in terms of time. A safety incident is something that tends to happen pretty quickly with an immediate effect. Whereas industrial hygiene has more sort of the health component. So thinking maybe about even in terms of EHS, the environmental piece is its own thing. The health piece is really where the CIH comes in. And then the S of safety is where the CSP would weigh in on those issues that are really more related to those kind of shorter term events, and then tracking trends. I think they spend, CSP is going to spend a lot of time looking at safety trends in the workplace, whereas a CIH is focused more along the kind of programmatic line of things in terms of what needs to be done to control against these, various hazards to prevent maybe a lead up to a safety incident.
Gotcha. Okay. Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, yeah, I was doing a little research online and kind of indicated that, the industry average for somebody who has their CIH certification is right around $105,000 a year, which was nearly $22,000 more than the median average salary, for say, a regular normal person that's maybe not credentialed, that's kind of practicing in the same capacity. So, that tells me that, there's some advantages of achieving and obtaining your CIH and CSP credential.
Yeah, there definitely is. You remind me, I need to go ask for a raise. Thank you for that prompt.
Okay. Right. Well, that's a good idea. Maybe that'll help you.
No, it's certainly something I think, my kids are teenagers and sort of at that cusp of entering the professional workplace. Got one about halfway through college, and one of the things that we've impressed upon them is developing that niche, that little space that you can be an expert in, or that thing that's going to differentiate you from the masses, so to speak, and going through the pain and going through the extra training maybe to develop that specific skill set. Certainly there's costs to that, but I do think they do pay dividends over time.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I think any young professional just starting out in the industry, especially in the environmental health and safety arena. These types of credentials should be like on their vision board or their goal, board to try to achieve as they develop in their career, because, it's going to advance your salary and then advances your knowledge, And you do need to spend a little time at the apprentice level, so to speak, right? And you got to spend a couple years, you know, grinding away at doing various tasks before you actually can sit for these exams. Isn't that right?
That's right. So the CIH used to be a 5-year requirement to work in the industrial hygiene space under the direction of another CIH for 5 years. And that's been fairly recently reduced to a four-year requirement. And there are some credits given towards undergraduate or graduate degree work in the industrial hygiene space. So yeah, there's a little bit of time in the saddle required before you can be qualified to sit for the exam. That's actually something I did not take for granted, even though I had already had my undergrad and graduate degrees in chemical engineering, was it was still no guarantee that I was going to be accepted to even sit for the exam. And I was, but in order to get there's a certain number of contact hours that are required in industrial hygiene specific academics. And so for me, that meant, you know, at the ripe old age of 40, going back and doing a little bit of online schooling, doing some continuing education, signed up basically for a CIH exam prep course that was real helpful. And again, that was at the prompting of some other folks in the CIH community. So I found that to be really helpful to me. It was also, I think it was a real benefit to show, you know, my kids again, that you never stop learning, you never stop thinking of ways to improve and kind of enhance your ability. And I know the salary is a piece of it, but I think more than anything, it's, you know, finding that place that you can have a rewarding career in helping other people. And, you know, I think the EHS space at large provides a good vector for that, kind of improving, you know, the health of the environment and the community around you and the workplace. You know, there's a lot of satisfaction in that outside of, you know, monetary compensation. So I think that's a big piece that can't be, you know, overstated.
So, yeah, I agree with you there for sure. And so it just goes to show you can teach an old dog new tricks, right?
Maybe a few.
Well, so it sounds like also based on what you're talking about, you know, you go through this credentialing, step of getting passing your exam, and now you become a CIH. Is there some sort of an organization that y'all become, you know, a part of if you join up in as a body of CIH members for, you know, continuing education? And you know, you talk about this brotherhood thing. You know, there's an organization you guys all participate in?
Yes. So the credentialing board is the ABIH, which is a subset of the Board of Global EHS Credentialing. So that's been a recent change too. The Bureau for Global EHS Credentialing, I think, oversees a couple of other certifications as well. But the CIH specifically is admitted through the American Board of Industrial Hygiene, ABIH. And then there's a professional association called the American Industrial Hygiene Association. There's also the International Occupational Hygiene Association, which is sort of a sister organization. And then there's another group called the American Council of Governmental Industrial Hygienists. And the AIHA is probably the one that most CIHs will join up, and they're the ones that sponsor a couple of annual conferences domestically in the United States, or I should say in North America. Sometimes it's held in Canada. And then there's, you know, those other organizations will oversee maybe some additional ones that are held internationally. Sure. I know the IOHA has one scheduled for later this year in South Korea. In fact, the president of the IOHA currently is a colleague of mine at the company I work at. And, you know, they're really, all of those organizations are active in, you know, promoting the interests of industrial hygiene, spend a fair amount of time sort of figuring out where we can slot in and help different organizations. For example, I was recently part of kind of building an effort to advancing the cause of industrial hygiene in the firefighter space or the emergency responder. You know, what issues may they not be as aware of or don't have as front of mind as they should in terms of their own workplace health and what can industrial hygienists do to sort of advance, you know, their own issues that they deal with on a regular basis. You think about a firefighter entering a burning building and potential smoke inhalation exposure, or, you know, simply the heat that's going to be involved in that, or, you know, any other of a host of conditions. And, you know, there's certainly a space there for an industrial hygienist that's sometimes overlooked. So
sure.
That's the role of those organizations, is to look for those gaps and try to, you know, advance the cause of industrial hygiene and in any of those spaces that there seem to be gaps.
Well, that's great. I mean, that kind of segues into my next question for you. You know, with all this COVID-19 pandemic going on in the world right now, what's the role of the CIH playing in the industry today? I mean, what are they doing to help companies?
Yeah, good question. And we certainly have seen a shift in focus from our normal course of business, which is, you know, more steady as she goes, industry, other exposure scenarios like we talked about, certainly some emergencies that pop up from time to time. But this is sort of an emergency to me. My initial reaction when this came around was, you know, this is sort of an emergency on a global scale. So how are we going to address this and solve the immediate problems that might crop up, but also, you know, be able to take the long view on a return to normal, hopefully. So what we've seen is, you know, the initial sort of lockdown, shutdown, frankly, if it were me looking backwards as sort of the Monday morning quarterback, and I made some of these comments at the time, is the role of the industrial hygienist in a pandemic is actually the name of a document that was published in 2006 by the American Industrial Hygiene Association. So I think there were a lot of IHs that pulled that document off their bookshelf and dusted it off. And in fact, the AIHA made it freely available for anybody that wants to look at it. And I think, you know, just a quick read through that document kind of summarizes the role of the IH in a pandemic, as the title suggests. And it's to put all of these different hazards and then their potential controls in perspective. So right out of the gate, I'm looking at it saying there's, you know, a certain segment of the population that's going to be more adversely affected than others. We deal with infectious disease all the time, every year during cold and flu season. What's going to be different about this? What strategies can we start to implement that are going to facilitate a return to normal? And, you know, immediately it seemed like one of the better strategies was to make sure that those more affected populations were going to take the controls necessary to protect themselves. And then the spread in general, you know, I think we saw one of the goals to, quote, flatten the curve was driven sort of with that same idea in mind, as we don't want to overwhelm the healthcare system. And then you have to start working on the data. You know, what is the data showing us? Are the hospitals able to keep up? Are the cases increasing at such a rate that it shows that we need to implement some more stringent measures? And, you know, a lot of that stuff, I think, behind the scenes was driven by some, you know, industrial hygiene voices in the community. And, you know, the epidemiologists, I think, you know, they have their bullet of looking at statistics and data, but the IH to me takes it a step further and says, okay, well, what can we do to fix it? How are we going to control it? As a person with an engineering background, that really has a draw to me, is always thinking about solutions.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things I like about industrial hygiene, is, okay, we've got to get the world back to normal, and how can we do that safely?
Well, so what are some of the things that the CIHs are doing to help, you know, companies resume operations? I mean, you know, we talk about the new normal. You know, I don't think we're going to resume to pre-COVID levels of, of occupational industrial working, I think, in the near future. So what do you think here?
So one of the things that we've done, I mean, we've seen a lot of businesses look at their existing business continuity and contingency plans. And I think we've seen a lot of businesses that have found that there were gaps in those plans.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding what it takes to document, not just to go through the activities that are necessary to remain in operation, but to document it appropriately for compliance purposes. So a couple of examples from a business continuity standpoint, is ensuring that you have a healthy workforce showing up to work and doing those temperature screens and, you know, maybe giving it a little more scrutiny than we have in the past, where somebody says, oh, I don't feel good, I'm going to go to the office anyway. And next thing you know, you have a little mini outbreak. Well, with this particular virus, it seems to be contagious enough that, you know, those outbreaks, and they can be sort of riding just slightly below the surface where people are asymptomatic and carrying the virus and don't know it. You know, how do we ensure that that's not happening at a facility-wide level, for example? So that's step one, is ensuring that you got a healthy workforce showing up to work. Step two is, if you do find that you have little hot spots cropping up, the last thing you want to do, say as a large facility, and we've been working with some fairly large companies, like in manufacturing, a big auto manufacturer up in Canada that has about 10,000 employees, one of the largest manufacturing facility complexes in North America. And trying to keep that workforce in operation, you know, has been a priority. And if hotspots do crop up, making sure that the response to that is not global, we've got to send all 10,000 or so people home, but it's surgical. Okay, here's where it was. This is how it happened. What can we do to sort of step back and put better protective measures in place or prevention measures in place to keep the facility at large operational? And so being able to sort of segue out those locations that maybe need a deep clean or that need to be temporarily shut down or a different workforce brought in, that's been one key. A second one, I would say, on the compliance, from a compliance perspective, is making sure that people are appropriately protected. And OSHA, for example, in the United States, has kept in place a compliance requirement for the respiratory protection program. The respiratory protection standard in U.S. law basically says that you've got to do an effective fit test and ensure that people know how to use any respirators that they use. And that's not trivial for us as industrial hygienists. When you start talking about putting people in respirators or any PPE for that matter, PPE is the sort of last resort measure, control measure on what we commonly refer to as the hierarchy of controls. There are a lot of other ways to control hazards, and PPE is that last ditch barrier between the person and the exposure. So what we found is, you know, educating companies on that fact, that they've got to train their employees, that they've got to do a proper fit test, that the employee has to understand what they can and can't do with that respirator, has been key. And so you've seen all the press about the N95s and the KN95s and how well they work and what the limitations are. And you know, there's really no PPE that's a true sort of magic bullet that's going to eliminate all risk. So understanding what those limitations are, we've spent a lot of time with different companies, you know, doing some very, very large respiratory protection program efforts, you know, in the thousands and thousands of employees type of thing, trying to get people up to speed again, and with the goal of keeping those places in operation.
Oh, so those are some kind of projects you've been doing since COVID hit with some of the industrial clients you're talking about. We're helping them, you know, do fit testing or you know, proper placement of PPE for employees on their person, huh?
That's right. And at sort of behind the scenes, what takes place with that is really an education piece and making sure that those programs are in place, making sure people understand the why of what they're doing. And again, all with the goal of let's get back to as normal as we possibly can, and, you know, not feel like that this is a hazard that we can't protect ourselves against.
Right.
Because I've found in my career, I've been in some, you know, particularly hazardous environments as part of some of the emergency response work that I do, but I've never run into a situation where there's been a hazard that couldn't be managed.
Right.
And so I think it's really taken a proactive approach towards business. Okay, we want to do what our core business is built around, which is make this widget or this car or, you know, be available for this particular service. And, you know, helping those companies continue to provide those services and goods is, you know, it's it's very satisfying, actually. It's something that I feel like it's empowering to those individuals and those companies to know that this is a, you know, just another hazard that can be managed.
Well, you know, and you know, you mentioned these various things that are great you know, aspects of managing this COVID, but talk a little bit, if you could, about just being on point with communication with employees about what's, you know, taking place in this new normal.
So, you know, at the employee level, one of the things that's probably different now from maybe even back in 2006 when that pandemic document came up is you see a wide array of experts, you know, weighing in at every hour of the day in 1,500 different ways. And it becomes a real fog of information where it's hard to tease out what you can trust and what you can't. And it's hard to tease out who's an expert that knows what they're talking about and who isn't, because the message is, there's such a wide gulf between, you know, the messages that you get from all of these different sources. And so, you know, one of the things that we've tried to do extremely diligently is to lay the facts out as they are. And, you know, sometimes the facts are, we just don't know. And I think at the very early outset of this outbreak, that was going to be the case quite a bit more than what we see today. Now we have a little bit better understanding of transmission, and we have a little bit better understanding of what the statistics are going to end up showing from an epidemiology standpoint. Okay, well, what is the infection fatality rate, for example? We see that falling continuously, even though as we see the case rates rise. So helping people filter that information and filter the data so that a clear picture emerges of, you know, again, given this hazard and its characteristics, what can be done to manage or control that hazard? I think that's where we find ourselves right now is, you know, for example, our workplace, we're open for business. Our office is open, but having people understand like they normally should during any cold and flu season, for example, and again, this is something I've tried to have a pretty consistent message with from the beginning, is use good hygienic practices. You know, this is very basic hygiene. It's being considerate of how we're breathing or transmitting, you know, the air we breathe. It's being considerate of those high touch surfaces and good hand sanitization practices and good surface sanitization practices. So all those things kind of coming into play, you know, that's the clear message I think that we're trying to, you know, bring back to the workplace, is it is possible to do work safely and, you know, even in groups. It's just a matter of, you know, being real considerate about that transmission piece and then understanding where those true risks are and those, you know, populations at risk, maybe taking some extra precautions.
Sure. So, you know, kind of a different little swing of the topics here with the CIH. What's your favorite type of CIH service you like to, you know, provide clients that, you know, you enjoy the most?
So I have, I really enjoy the education piece. And to me that, you know, typically comes in the form of telling war stories. A lot of my career has been spent with some very unique exposure scenarios because of my work in emergency response. And I would say that emergency response is my favorite, but I still have kind of a love-hate relationship with emergency response. it's not convenient to family or to your own life to wake up in the middle of the night and run out the door. But at the same time, it's really led me into a lot of, like I said, very unique experiences that I'm able to parlay into, you know, again, those war stories and lessons learned and things like that, that really help other people. So emergencies typically are born from events that are, you know, sort of the unfortunate convergence, like a perfect storm you know, a number of different risk factors. And oftentimes in hindsight, you're able to sort of reconstruct what those conditions were and what led to that incident happening. And often for somebody that hasn't been through an emergency like that, they can't envision how that would ever happen to them. But if you paint that picture for them and say, here's the incident, here's what led up to it, I think that really opens people's eyes and helps them think proactively about different means of controlling that hazard in their own facility or their own personal life. Even I like to take some of those war stories and sort of bring them back home and say, you know, what if this truck overturns in my neighborhood?
Yeah.
You know, what am I going to do with my family? And just helping people sort of think creatively, you know, around what hazards they may run into on a day-to-day basis. And so I really enjoy that kind of educational piece. It gives it kind of tickles that imagination part of my brain and others.
Yeah, that's good. So, well, what type of services are you and your team offering clients?
So we've got in our group probably about 50 total industrial hygienists that are doing industrial hygiene, you know, almost on a full-time basis. I work at a large firm that, you know, is able to accommodate with field staff and, you know, other professionals executing some of the work that, you know, people may not be full-time industrial hygienists. So we end up doing quite a bit of advising of, you know, other folks within the firm. On typical projects for us are sampling surveys inside facilities, you know, as I mentioned, noise, chemicals, physical hazards, ergonomics is another piece that we do some of, you know, that's sort of the normal course of business type work that we do, across a lot of different sectors. So we do, you know, a fair amount in manufacturing, we do a fair amount in oil and gas, petrochemical, pulp and paper, transportation, you name it. You know, we've got clients kind of all across the map that we do those sorts of tasks for on a day-to-day basis. And then I would say about our group, probably about 20% of the time, we do spend responding to and recovering from emergency scenarios. So helping people understand if there's a spill of this or that, you know, again, what the hazards are and what levels they need to be controlled to. And so that takes up a fair amount of our time as well, writing plans and implementing those plans.
Gotcha. All right. That's great. I mean, I think it's an essential service that needs to be provided in the industry, because not every company can have a CIH on staff to help them, you know, do the work and identify the remedies to keep their people safe. So that's great. One, you know, the name of our podcast is called the Environmental Transformation Podcast, Dyren. And so I always try to kind of ask the one question with most of the guests is, you know, how are you transforming the way, you know, say GHD or you approaches industrial hygiene services?
Yeah, good question. We, you know, we're at a real pivotal point in history, I think, and I'm sure, you know, generations past have probably thought the same thing. And so I try to look at what is changing today that influences the way we conduct our business. And I think one of the primary things is that immediacy, that availability of information. And so we spend what I'm seeing and what we're calling internally an objective, a goal, a roadmap, a strategy, a vision for our group is beyond compliance. So we feel real comfortable in our day-to-day operations doing those compliance related activities. What we would like to see with the companies that we work with and the other groups that we work with, the agencies and whatnot, is how do we look beyond compliance at, you know, possibly things that are not just controlling hazards, but learning to benefit from the workplace that we're working in. So, you know, a good example is one of our team members is involved in ergonomics and has identified some industries where, say, you're lifting a heavy object over and over. And so from that standpoint, you've got a real risk of back injury or shoulder injury and in that workplace. And at the same time, you see people down at your CrossFit gym, you know, doing pull-ups and lifting heavy weights. And you're thinking, well, is it actually possible that you can get a benefit from, you know, from your workplace and from the things that you do? And so thinking proactively, and one thing that we haven't maybe achieved yet in the U.S. is that mentality of a full mentality of prevention.
Right.
And
right.
that could be, you know, having an employee in an office setting taking a mental health break, or having an employee in a facility that has a real noisy environment, you know, finding an alternative for that employee, or finding, you know, physical controls for that setting that that make it a, you know, a more comfortable place to work, and maybe even a health benefit. I think shifting the perspective of, you know, the work is the thing that you do when you're not getting to do what you want. You know, shifting that more towards, no, you know, I really get a lot of satisfaction out of my job.
Sure.
And helping companies get to that point.
Right.
So at the, what we call the advisory level, you know, that's what we're spending some time doing, is identifying those opportunities, you know, for companies that want to be a bit more proactive and think about where, and frankly, if you want to look at it from that company's perspective, their bottom line is helped by having a healthy workforce.
Sure.
Their
Absolutely.
Costs are going to be significantly reduced yeah. over time from lost time or injury or other work, you know, workers' comp issues. Obviously, if you're working way upstream of those issues and you can help a company in that proactive space beyond compliance, you've got a real chance to, you know, impact their bottom line. So that's satisfying on all fronts.
No, that's good. Well, I'd love to hear that concept and that approach, and how you're trying to transform the way clients approach industrial hygiene. That's fantastic. I mean, you know, this podcast interview has been going super well. I think we could probably end up going on for maybe another 30 minutes if we wanted to, but I do need to kind of, yeah. you know, we need to kind of keep it short for the listeners a bit here. So, you know, I wanted to close with a couple questions here. So the listeners kind of get to know you a little bit, but you know, hey, what are some of the hobbies you have outside of work?
So back in 2003, I got into triathlon.
Oh, okay.
So anything swimming, biking, running, I enjoy. And then it's all, you know, family time and church stuff after that. So
Sure. Well, that's yeah. good. Well, I do know you like a little golf in there, too.
I do like a little yeah. golf. You're right. As I age, I find I'm that's something I can get better at. I'm only getting slower at triathlon.
So. I feel you, brother. I feel you on that one. So, okay. Yeah. So how do people get a hold of you? So maybe they want to learn a little bit more about CIH services and maybe that little, you know, beyond compliance approach to industrial hygiene.
Sure. Yeah. I'm on LinkedIn, Dyron Hamlin. My name is a hard one. So it's like Byron with a D. I'm sure you'll have it posted up on the title there, but yeah, that's usually if I'm Google, you can Google Dyron and it's going to land Dyron Industrial Hygiene. You'll find me, but I work at GHD here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And yeah, email me, check me out on LinkedIn. I'm around and active.
So it's dyron.hamlin@ghd.com.
That's it.
Perfect.
Easy, except for the spelling.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll put a link down here in the podcast for everyone to get a hold of. You know, hey, buddy, thanks for coming on the show today. Looking forward to catching up with you here in the near future. And then, you know what? We'll probably try to bring you back on down the road. Maybe you've got some new projects or interesting things you'd like to share again, and we'll bring you back on for a recap.
Yep, that sounds great. No, I appreciate it, Sean. Always like talking to IH.
I want to thank our guest, Dyron Hamlin, for coming on to the show today. If you have questions about becoming a certified industrial hygienist or CIH services GHD offers, please feel free to contact Dyron via email at dyron.hamlin@ghd.com. We'll also put a link to his contact information on my webpage. To listen to future Environmental Transformation podcasts, you can check us out on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and other podcast networks, or from my website at www.seankgrady.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, make a positive impact in someone's life today.